I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Julie Stein from the Wildlife Friendly Enterprise Network. We'll talk about certification of wildlife-friendly products and how this can help conserve threatened wildlife while contributing to the economic vitality of rural communities. We'll also get an update on elephant seals from Christine Heinrichs, a docent at Piedras Blancas Elephant Seal Rookery in California. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call comes from a critically endangered bird that lives in Cambodia. Now, here's your preview. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Julie Stein from the Wildlife Friendly Enterprise Network. I'm really excited about today's show because what you're going to hear is a great story about people making a difference and how you, through your own purchases, can help. You've probably heard about eco-labeling. You've likely even bought some environmentally friendly products. Perhaps it's been fair trade coffee or organic or locally grown produce. Well, this group is taking eco-labeling a step further and creating a trademark for wildlife-friendly products. What's particularly interesting is that products with this label not only help an endangered species, but also, at the same time, generate income and economic opportunities in the communities that live with these animals. Julie will tell us about several of these products, like elephant pepper. Did you know that elephants don't like pepper? Well, farmers in Kenya are using that fact and now plant pepper plants around their fields. That stops elephants from raiding their crops and also creates a new product for them to sell. Projects like elephant pepper change incentives within the communities so that rather than seeing wildlife as a nuisance, the communities want to protect the animals and their habitat because they gain too. Julie Stein, co-founder and secretary of the board of the Wildlife Friendly Enterprise Network, will tell us more about these win-win-win situations that ultimately support a triple bottom line of people, planet, and profits. Julie is a conservation biologist and consultant and has worked on large carnivore conservation in the greater Yellowstone region, as well as on African endangered species conservation issues. She served as the science and policy coordinator for the Bushmeat Crisis Task Force and, from 2001 to 2003, was part of an interdisciplinary international research team examining conservation and community conflict for the Jane Goodall Institute's Congo Basin program. Julie is on the advisory committee for Predator Friendly and is one of the founding steering committee members of the Human-Wildlife Conflict Collaboration, where she is helping to develop a conservation and conflict training program for wildlife professionals around the world. In 2006, Julie founded Scentmark Consulting and is researching green marketing trends to provide assistance and tools to promote wildlife-friendly product lines. When we talked recently, I asked Julie to tell me what first got her interested in wildlife-friendly enterprises.
As many of us that I think get involved in this wildlife conservation field, it seems like journeys are circuitous and we think we're going to be working out in the field with wildlife and we end up doing lots of other things, which is what makes it such an interesting, it's not really a profession, but life journey. And I think it probably started a long time ago for me because I had an art gallery back in the 90s and felt like I wanted to be much more involved in wildlife conservation and ended up going back to school and going to the Yale School of Forestry. And while I was at Yale, became aware of a project out in Montana called Predator Friendly. And I was just so intrigued because I was really interested in carnivore conservation. And I heard about this lady sheep rancher named Becky Weed, who actually is from Maine, but had moved to Belgrade, Montana. And was not only a sheep rancher, but a predator advocate, and was
What is a predator advocate?
Well, a predator advocate, I guess, is someone who is passionate about predators. And part of the reason I'm passionate about predators is because they play such an important role in the ecosystem. There's been so much work done about especially, and the reason I went back to school is because of wolf reintroduction in the Rocky Mountain West and Yellowstone. That just captured my imagination in the 90s and led to me closing my retail business and applying to Yale, going back to school, which was a huge undertaking at age 38. But so I had a fire lit under me, and I think predators are intelligent. We've had a long kind of conflictual relationship with them. Barry Lopez has written eloquently about it in Of Wolves and Men, and it's just fascinating to me. So and for some reason, there are a lot of women that are predator advocates, and Becky Weed in Montana was one of them. And to me, the paradox of being a sheep rancher and a predator advocate was fascinating. So I wanted to learn more about her, and she eventually became kind of a role model and mentor for me. And she's one of the founders of Predator Friendly.
Tell me more about Predator Friendly, because it's interesting, because especially out in Montana, out west, there mm-hmm. is so much conflict between predators and livestock, or I should say perceived conflict, and people are really against predators there.
Yeah, and there's a lot of history behind that, which is a whole show unto itself, but a lot of times large predators and other charismatic mammals that come into conflict with human beings, a lot of times it's a conflict about human values more than it is an actual conflict with the predators. Now, some predators do prey on livestock under certain circumstances, and some predators are dangerous around people. Grizzly bears can be. But oftentimes the predators end up being more of a symbol of things that people object to. Out west, people are very independent and have a long, proud history. The ranching culture and tradition is an important part of our national history. And they feel threatened sometimes on a lot of different levels. Economically, they don't want government interference and so forth. And I understand all of those sentiments. And I also have livestock, so I understand how upsetting it is when you come out and find, something you've worked hard for dead on the ground. So understandably, there's been a long conflicted history. But I think when one of the things that became apparent to me is that mostly people want to be respected, and they don't want outsiders telling them how to do something they know how to do very well. So as conservationists, it's been a kind of a long journey from being activist, which is also an important role, but also learning how to work with people collaboratively. And predators are kind of a test case for all those things. And so that's another reason that they're so fascinating to me.
And so tell me more about Predator
Friendly.
And how
Predator Friendly is the basic premise behind Predator Friendly, which came out of a conversation between a rancher and a conservationist, is that, and it's all now part of the sustainable agriculture movement, but what it does is the producer signs an affidavit saying that they won't kill native predators in the production of what it is they're producing. And that could be livestock, it could be honey, it could be wool, it could be lamb. I think we have a bison producer that's certified. And by signing that affidavit, they can then use a predator-friendly stamp on their products and become part of a community that's having a dialogue about sustainable agriculture.
Now, you've been personally involved with Predator Friendly, right?
I've been involved in different ways with Predator Friendly for a long time, I think almost a decade now. It's unbelievable to say that. But and they're administered by a group in Bozeman, Montana called Keystone Conservation now, whose board I was on, and now I'm an advisor to Predator Friendly. So in describing Predator Friendly at meetings in Washington, D.C., where there were a lot of international conservation folks, we started getting inquiries from people in Namibia, from people working on cheetahs in Botswana, Namibia, also jaguar conservationists in Brazil, who said, wow, this is kind of a neat idea to market your goods with this eco-label on it. We'd like to be part of that.
So what happened?
So we started having a discussion about how do you create an international trademark and a global eco-label that would really expand beyond predators to all endangered wildlife around the world. And that conversation bubbled to the surface, and just through luck, or maybe not luck, maybe work, we found a funder who was willing to help us do the work to get the international trademark and have a meeting in 2007 at the White Oak Conservation Center down in Yulee, Florida, where we brought in all these international participants that had said they were interested in having this discussion. We had a representative from Whole Foods there. It was a really exciting meeting. And we invited representatives from some of the existing eco labels like Rainforest Alliance, because we definitely wanted to make sure we weren't reinventing the wheel and spending the money wisely that we had.
And what was the result?
At the end of that 3-day meeting, the answer was yes, we should move forward with creating another label called Wildlife Friendly that would kind of be an umbrella over a lot of these existing eco labels. And that's kind of the genesis of Wildlife Friendly. Predator Friendly planted the seed, I guess, and still exists as a domestic trademark across, I think, 12 states now.
Can you tell me more about this Wildlife Friendly certification and how it works?
We started certifying last year. So we now, Wildlife Friendly now has 8 certified product lines on 3 continents, I believe.
Can you tell me about some of these products?
One of my favorite examples and one of the inspirations for Wildlife Friendly for me is Elephant Pepper, which is a product. It's spices and salsa produced in several countries in Africa. The idea behind it is, elephants are only protected across Africa in about 20% of their range, formally protected. So they come into conflict with local farmers a lot. And conflicts with elephants in Africa are really dangerous. People can get killed. Elephants can get killed. And in a single night, an elephant can wipe out an entire family's crop by raiding a field. These farmers are some of the poorest people in the world. They're working in countries where there's drought, all kinds, against all odds, trying to feed their family. And an elephant moving through a field in one night can destroy that whole crop. So it's devastating. And they've also, elephants can kill people pretty easily. And then elephants, which are in various levels of endangerment across Africa, depending on where you are, get killed in retribution. So it's not a good situation for anybody.
So how does Elephant Pepper help?
I guess the thing that's so exciting about some of these projects, really all of them, is they create win-win-win situations. So in response to this human-elephant conflict, which, some of the traditional responses have been to put up solar-powered electric fencing, different patrols, which have varying levels of success, but this researcher, Loki Osborne, who's an American PhD elephant researcher, discovered that elephants don't like the smell of chili pepper. They don't respond well to the capsicum that's in chilies. And so he started experimenting with planting a chili pepper border around the crops that the farmers were trying to protect. And in fact, elephants don't like to cross the chili pepper border.
Really?
Yeah. He originally got this idea from thinking about bear pepper spray, and I think that kind of sparked the initial idea for him. But then he realized, well, gosh, now I have to ask these very poor farmers that have lots of other issues on their mind to plant chili pepper borders, and that's going to be a burden for them. So he guaranteed them that he would buy their entire crop of chili peppers if they would plant the chili pepper borders. So then he had all this, all these chilies he had to figure out something to do with, which was actually a boon because it created another cash crop for the farmers. And I think in some cases it's tripled the annual income of the farmers that are participating. So he's now creating salsa, which is available in some Whole Foods now across the country. He's improved the lives of the farmers. He's reduced human-elephant conflict. He's, through the product sales, being able to tell the story of human-elephant conflict. Conservation isn't as black and white as sometimes people think. There's lots of gray areas, and it's a lot more complicated, and this is one way to share those stories. So for me, this is a win-win-win situation, and I think it's just so funny because in one of my early job interviews when I was first starting out after grad school in conservation, I had my prospective boss during the interview tell me that there was no such thing as a win-win in conservation. And I guess looking back, I just think, yes. there is, and I'm here to prove it.
Sometimes it's those naysayers that get you to...
Yeah, so it's a very happy story. Now, it's not easy to get to these win-win-wins. It takes a lot of hard work. And what it's involved for people like Loki is he was used to, he jokes that he was used to being out in the field by himself counting elephant dung, and now he's a fancy food purveyor. And the long journey that that's been, figuring out the import, export, and marketing and packaging and the hygiene issues for producing food, it's just almost insurmountable task. So for a project that's gotten that done, we're very happy and proud.
As you should be. Now, how can someone find this elephant pepper?
Whole Foods is carrying elephant pepper. I don't know if it's in every Whole Foods across the country because Whole Foods tailors what's on their shelves, but it's definitely available through Whole Foods. You can also buy elephant pepper through their website. They have a .com and a .org site where you can learn more about the stories, and also directly purchase the products from them.
Do you have that site?
Yeah, it's elephantpepper.com.
Oh, well, that's easy.
Yeah. And the .org site tells more about the science and wildlife issues behind the product. The .com site you can buy the products from.
When something is sold like the elephant pepper here, what percentage goes, you know, how does it translate to income for the farmer?
Right. Well, those statistics are going to be different for each one of the projects, and I don't have hard numbers, but I think this, from what Loki has conveyed to us, is that in some case, I mean, some of these people are living on, you know, $400 or $500 a year income. And so in some cases, through the purchase of the peppers from the farmers, it may double or triple their annual income. And that's true of a lot of our projects, because the people are living at such poverty levels that it's easy to really improve their standard of living, you know, exponentially.
And are there any side benefits outside of income?
In some cases, like we've just certified Ann Kent Taylor in Kenya, who works with ecotourism and also doing anti-snaring and anti-poaching sweeps through the Maasai Mara in Kenya. Projects like that might be also contributing to improving education for children, paying for wells to be drilled so that kids don't have to walk miles for fresh water.
Are there other projects that have these types of corollary benefits?
Our Wildlife Works project, which is also in Kenya, Mike Korchinski has created a corridor between Tsavo East and Tsavo West national parks that elephants use.
And what did he do?
Built an eco factory there, which has employed a lot of community members. Families of ex-poachers are involved in both of those projects, Ann Kent Taylor's and Wildlife Works. Wildlife Works is creating organic cotton in their eco factory. And like I said, working with the families who may have formerly been poaching as a way to survive. So it's not only improving the monetary income, but also, you know, building healthcare centers, improving the roads, all kinds of helping to educate the kids, buy books, vaccinate livestock, all kinds of things.
Tell me how the certification works. What's the process if someone has an idea or their ongoing projects that want the certification? What's the advantage of the certification? There's a lot of questions, right?
I think I got them. If there's a project and we have some criteria, and one of those is there has to be key species resident at the project site. And key species for us are on the IUCN, International Union for Conservation, red list. Or we've also given ourselves the latitude to kind of make executive decisions about what key species are in case they're not red listed, but we feel they're critical for other reasons, you know, maybe climate change or some other extenuating circumstance, but there has to be endangered wildlife on the premises. So that's the first kind of bar that a project would have to reach. Then they could submit a pre-application, which includes a letter of reference. They have to answer some questions. And if we may go back to them with, you know, clarifying questions. If everything looks good, we'll move to the full application and they can gain certification. So that's kind of the process, and it's all laid out on the Wildlife Friendly website, which is wildlifefriendly.org.
And is there a peer review for who makes the decision on what is certified?
We have a certification committee. A subset of our board is a certification committee, and we have a lot of expertise on the board. Also, the board is connected to a lot of expertise, so we have a pretty big network of people that we can call on if we have questions. We also have board members that have visited a lot of these sites through their work, so they may know the project already or be familiar with the project staff already. Now, as we expand, that won't always be the case, so we'll maybe have to be doing more field visits in the future. But right now, with our 8 projects, we've been pretty familiar with the projects and know that they're doing really good work. But we require references. We want evaluation and monitoring protocols in place. And we also want high-quality products. The local communities need to be involved, and the production has to have a positive impact on the local community. And the individuals living with the wildlife have to be participating in the production and harvest or processing and manufacture of the product. And there has to be a clear enforcement mechanism with follow-through so that if endangered wildlife are killed, that would result in the certification being revoked. So that's kind of how the certification process works. I think the other part of that question was, what is the benefit of the certification?
Right. Have you seen, an increase in the price of the product with the certification?
Well, this is like a whole area of expertise into itself that I've been trying to learn about in the past year. And I can give you a little bit of background. The demand for green products and services is growing. It's a really strong market, even in the economy that we're in now. And the Natural Marketing Institute, which does research into this kind of thing, estimates the products and services in the green marketplace will reach $420 billion this year. So it's a huge market. And what's exciting is people are going to purchase products anyway, but wouldn't it be great if those purchases were contributing to saving habitat, to preserving human cultural diversity and improving livelihoods and saving endangered wildlife? So this is our dream, that the products and services that people buy every day will be kind of doing triple duty and supporting the triple bottom line of people, planet, and profits. And that's kind of what Wildlife Friendly is all about.
And how does this Wildlife Friendly certification reinforce that triple bottom line of people, planet, and profits?
There's a growing skepticism. Consumers are kind of getting more sophisticated, and an eco-label is something that is a response to that. So another survey, a 2007 survey, showed that 75% of green consumers want to see that seal or certification mark indicating that a product is environmentally friendly, and that raises the likelihood that they'll purchase it. So that's kind of the value in an eco-label. There are a lot of eco-labels, but Wildlife Friendly is the only label that's focusing exclusively on wildlife and communities. So we feel like we're filling a niche that isn't out there right now, and hopefully giving consumers, by purchasing wildlife-friendly products, you're covering a lot of bases. You're not only supporting wildlife, saving endangered wildlife, but supporting those local communities that are taking the risk by living near these endangered wildlife.
And what about price premiums for certified products?
It's kind of, the recent research shows that consumers will pay a 5 to 10% premium for green products if they believe those products are healthier, safer, or better for the environment. So it still has to be an excellent, high-quality product, but there is a segment of consumers that are willing to pay a premium for those products if everything else is equal.
That's really interesting. I love that, the triple bottom line that you talked about, the people, planet, and profit.
Companies, even big Fortune 500 companies, are now really paying attention to this and hiring corporate sustainability officers, and this is a big deal. It's kind of becoming... They feel that it's kind of moved from a niche market to a mainstream market. And so, where you used to only be able to buy these products at places like Whole Foods, kind of more luxury retailers, now Target and Walmart are huge players in this field, and they can actually influence the manufacture and supply chains of entire countries. So I never thought I would see it within my lifetime, so it's a pretty exciting shift, and I think it's here to stay. I don't think we're going back to the old way of doing business anymore.
I'd love to have you describe some more examples. I was interested in you taking me through that Ann Kent Taylor project, because you had mentioned it was helping with anti-poaching as well. How does that work?
Well, she's working with local Maasai communities living near the Mara. Those communities, there's two issues there. As you know, in Kenya, there's poaching from outsiders from Somalia that come in, and then because of predation on Maasai cattle and goats, there's sometimes retribution killings by Maasai. And so Anne is really working. She has an ecotourism company, but she also, in conjunction with that, does anti-poaching and anti-snaring sweeps of the Mara with Kenya Wildlife Service and youth and patrols that she works with. She has some wildlife veterinarians that she works with as well. And then she's also taking the Maasai beadwork and marketing it back here in the United States. So the economic benefit goes back to the Maasai. And one of the things we found, it's just really important for the communities that you make the ties between, you know, the economic benefits really clear, the economic benefits and the presence of wildlife. Because sometimes when you live near lions, it's not the most convenient thing in the world, especially when you're trying to raise livestock. So those are the people that are taking those risks. But the global community, you know, by and large, is interested in having lions continue to exist on Earth. So I think what's really important to me is that as conservationists and even as just citizens around the world that appreciate wildlife, have to start paying more of the cost of these wildlife. And Wildlife Friendly is kind of a way of doing that, because by buying these products, you're helping those communities that are really assuming all of the risk and not getting much of the benefit, while we reap the benefits when we go on safari in Africa or watch lions on the National Geographic or the Discovery Channel.
So in that case, the benefit is a little less direct than, say, the elephant pepper, because it's the Maasai beadwork that's being marketed and certified. Is that right?
Exactly. It's a little, each one of these is slightly different, and that's why they're so interesting. So the sales of the beadwork, and also Anne does a lot of work with the local communities, vaccinating animals, digging wells, working with the local Maasai in lots of different ways. So the benefits aren't just from the sale of the beadwork. She's building tolerance in a lot of different ways. They've installed a grain mill that's, you know, providing more of a steady income. So all kinds of ripple out effects.
Because I know that there's been a lot of press about the poisoning of lions in retribution.
Exactly.
From, you know, for the predation by Maasai. And so it's really interesting to start to get them to, you know, to get a benefit from the lions.
Exactly.
What is then the benefit for the Maasai of having the lions there?
Well, Anne tries to make it very clear that the tourists that she brings in, the sales from the bracelets, the wells being drilled, the grain mill, working with the school children, all of these things are directly connected. She talks to the village chiefs and so forth, so that they understand that poaching or retribution killing, all these benefits go away. She's the bringer of all the good things, but what is important to her is that the wildlife are not killed, and she makes that really clear with the community she's working with.
And so ecotourism is a big part of it.
She has an ecotourism company. And I should just mention that one of the areas that we're expanding into this year is wildlife-friendly certified ecotourism, because many of our projects have lodges on site or have plans to build lodges. We have Elephant Pepper has a lodge. Ann Kent Teller does ecotourism trips. We have Wildlife Works. Mike Korchinski has a lodge. We have another certified project called It's Wild. That's the brand name, which is in Zambia, and that's one of the sites I've visited. They work with ecotourism and have a lodge as well. So we haven't done it yet, but we're moving into the ecotourism sector, which is also just really exciting to me. And we're just in the beginning stages of that, but we're going to move forward with that this year.
Because a lot of the ecotourist places are really ecologically and financially sustainable. But there's been others. I know I had a guest on the show earlier who was talking about a case of turtle tourism.
Right.
Where, you know, in one breath you're going out and looking at these beautiful turtles and snorkeling and whatnot, and then you go in the restaurant and you eat turtle meat.
Right.
I assume that wouldn't be certified, but it would be really useful to have that certification because tourists don't know, you don't know always what you're getting.
Even on a recent trip to Tanzania, it wasn't a solely wildlife friendly trip, but we were doing some wildlife friendly presentations, and our hosts, you know, wanted to serve us basically bushmeat because to them that was an honor. For us, you know, coming in from out of town, and we had to specify, thank you for the hospitality, but we that's not something that we eat.
I'd love for you to tell me about another project, the one on ibis rice.
Ibis rice is an organically grown rice that is wildlife friendly certified. It's grown in the northern plains of Cambodia, which is home animals and water birds beyond the savannas of Africa, which is kind of a surprise. And the giant ibis is Cambodia's national bird and one of about 50 endangered species in the northern plains. This is a Wildlife Conservation Society project, and the rice is in bulk, and also I think they have plans to sell it in smaller kind of boutique packages.
So it's planted in the same habitat?
There are, you know, human communities that are on that same habitat and those natural resources. So by encouraging farmers to plant the rice, it's preventing habitat conversion. I do have some statistics here. The initial 78 farmers involved in the project each received $60 in additional income, which is, it sounds like nothing to us here, but considering that their average annual income is less than $400 per year, 60 additional dollars is a tremendous amount. And in 2008, they expanded from 2 villages to 10 villages. So now over 10,000 people are involved. So it really has improved the incomes and provided a lot of benefits, training, access to credit at reduced interest rates, and so forth to these communities.
If they weren't planting the rice, then there would have been habitat conversion. So they would have built homes on it or done other agricultural stuff. And
yeah, and I guess the point there is that land is one of the most valuable things that those people have. So the land might be more valuable to them used in other ways. And so the production of ibis rice and the marketing of wildlife friendly ibis rice gives more value to keeping the land as suitable habitat for the bird.
And so then where is the rice being sold?
Right now, they mostly have a regional market for it, but we are working on ways to start packaging it so that it can be exported for purchase. I mean, we'd love to have it in places like Whole Foods. Now they're targeting hotels and restaurants that tourists, there are a lot of, I think I mentioned birding tourists in Cambodia. So right now they're mostly marketing the rice regionally and locally. And that's true with some of our products make more sense to market regionally and locally. Some of them make sense to export. And some of them are kind of moving up that scale from regional and local to export markets.
Oh, interesting. You had also talked about some essential oils from Madagascar. Can you tell me about that project?
This is a company called Aroma Forest, and they produce a range of essential oils. Some of them people might recognize the names Ylang Ylang, cinnamon bark, different blue ginger, different essential oils. And these oils from Madagascar then eventually end up with aromatherapy companies, international companies like Chanel and Yves Rocher, who purchase oils from these companies. So they're certified wildlife friendly. They're also certified organic and also satisfies international fair trade requirements. So that's one thing I haven't mentioned. Many of our, a few of our certified product lines have multiple certifications, not just wildlife friendly. And I guess just some background, Madagascar is one of the poorest countries in the world. There's an average annual per capita income between $300 and $500. So very poor people, a lot of unsustainable land practices where
Madagascar has lost about 85% of its native forest cover, but there's an extremely high rate of biodiversity. It's an island nation, and 90% of the species are endemic, which means they exist nowhere else but Madagascar. And lemurs are probably the poster child for endemic species in Madagascar. So the production of these essential oils is really beneficial to the local communities. This is a global business, and
Production of them, of the essential oils, does that compete with land for habitat for the lemurs?
No, we wouldn't have been able to certify them. Part of the certification criteria is that. Is that the production actually is working towards conserving habitat for the endangered species that are present. So that's definitely part of our certification criteria for any project. So we can say that that's not the case.
What's been the impact?
I can give you a few more statistics. Right now, about 300 families are benefiting, and $35,000 is being generated, which is staying in the local communities. They're producing about 2,000 kilograms of essential oils a year now.
And how much, I guess, trying to get a sense of what that really means in terms of perfume production?
I don't know. And this is just one ingredient in these perfumes. They use lots of different ingredients. So the end product isn't certified as wildlife friendly. We're not at the place yet where we can say Chanel perfume is wildlife friendly, but this ingredient sourced for Chanel perfume is. And so, we're hoping that companies like Chanel will see the benefit in having, my dream would be that one of their perfume lines would be completely sourced from wildlife-friendly essential oils, and that could be a possibility in the future that a company like Chanel would see the benefit in that. We have another project in Nepal called Himalayan Biotrade that is sourcing essential oils and also paper from the Lokta shrub, which is a perennial shrub. It's beautiful dyed paper produced in these high Himalayan communities. And Aveda, another cosmetics company, uses products from Himalayan Biotrade, and their products are not only certified wildlife friendly, but also are Forest Stewardship Council certified. And Aveda is a great green company and doing lots of good work. So we're proud to be kind of a little part of their larger family.
Now, it's interesting because you said, so Chanel is not marketing and Yves Rocher are not marketing the end product as a wildlife-friendly product. So it's interesting because the oil must be of high enough quality and just on its own be in demand.
Right. Well, I think Madagascar is one of the places where people go for kind of bioprospecting things. There's all kinds of biodiversity there that's not present other parts of the world. So to be able to do it sustainably, harvest this stuff sustainably and in a way that's benefiting communities and wildlife is a great thing for the people of Madagascar. And, maybe someone from Chanel will hear this and decide that, it's time to produce a wildlife-friendly perfume. We would love that. So we welcome inquiries.
And then Aveda, tell me a little bit more about that, the Himalayan company.
Biotrade?
Yeah.
In Nepal, there are community forest groups, and they do a lot of non-timber forest product harvesting. So Himalayan Biotrade is making this beautiful paper, as I mentioned. They can make business cards. They can custom make a lot of things out of this paper. I have some here at my house. It's just beautiful, at the dyes that they use, the natural dyes and so forth. And like I said, they have Forest Stewardship Council certification for the paper as well. And Aveda, you can actually Google this and find it online, but Aveda, especially for their holiday gift packs, uses this paper to, it's like a holiday gift pack with paper, this beautiful paper, as part of the packaging for the Aveda cosmetics. They're using the wildlife friendly paper, and you can search online. There's a great video that shows where the paper is where the bark is harvested and how the paper is made by these communities. And these communities are living, you know, 57% of them are living below the poverty line. They're in very remote mountain communities, subsisting on $59 a year, some of them. So this is a significant source of income for them. And when these resources are harvested unsustainably, it can lead to soil erosion and landslides and habitat loss, as well as illegal trade in animal products across the border to Tibet. So
what kind of species are benefiting from the Himalayan biotrade?
In this region, the key species are gray wolf, the Himalayan tar leopard, musk deer, pangolin, red panda, and wild yak. And they also, these districts border on habitat for endangered snow leopards. So there's plenty of endangered wildlife up there that can benefit.
So it's protecting the way they're producing the paper and essential oils protects the habitat of all of these animals. Is that right?
Right. And I'm just looking at some of the statistics. In 2008, they created a lot of jobs at different stages of the supply chain, and over $1.5 million in revenue was generated for these poor forest communities. So this is a really significant business that's benefiting.
How much revenue was created?
$1.5 million in revenue was generated for the forest communities in 2008.
Really?
And part of this is being able to link to companies like Aveda, you know, high-profile companies that want to source their raw materials in a responsible, ethical way.
So how do you get companies like that to learn about these products and to link? And how do you interest them in having that label? So how could you convince Chanel to do that?
I think it's from the corporate side, I think corporations are seeing the light now more than ever. As I was saying earlier in the call, I think they're highly motivated now to be more responsible and ethical in their sourcing and every level of their business. For these remote rural communities to link to global markets is a more difficult link. And luckily, on our steering committee, we have some of this expertise. There's an organization based in D.C. called Enterprise Works Vita. Now they're called Relief International. But one of our board members has been working directly with Himalayan Biotrade for years, helping them make these kind of links. And they also have great in-country staff people that are working on behalf of the communities. But it's not an easy task, and this is what people's careers are based on, is trying to a lot of nonprofits in DC, this is what they're working towards, is helping make these links for the communities, for the wildlife, and to reach global markets, part of our role, Wildlife Friendly, we want to be able to promote these stories and the products to the rest of the world. I think one other link that I should mention is Wildlife Friendly has a partnership with a website called World of Good by eBay, and it's a partnership with the online auction giant eBay to try to benefit communities and give these communities access to global markets. And last year, Wildlife Friendly was granted a role as a trust provider on the website World of Good by eBay, so that we are now one of the kind of gateways. If you're a community that wants to post products on World of Good by eBay, which is also connected to the regular eBay site, there are a group of certification marks that you can go through, and Wildlife Friendly is now one of those ways to gain access to the website, so that all of the goods on that website are linked to some kind of eco-label or trust provider, and we're now one of those trust providers.
And that's worldofgood.com?
It's World of, let me see, I can bring it up, World of Good by eBay. I can get you the
That's really, so it's almost like eBay is, so eBay has, I had no idea about this.
Yeah, so, it's a philanthropic side of eBay. It's worldofgood.ebay.com. And every site, every product that's listed on World of Good by eBay is also listed on the regular eBay site. So it helps these remote artisans reach a global market. It's a great idea. And if you look on the website, there's all kinds of things to explore. When you click on a product, you link to the stories behind that product. Now, not every one of these products is linked to benefiting wildlife. Some of them are linked to different things, but it's consumers can make a choice of what causes they want to support through the purchase of these beautiful, absolutely beautiful products that are offered.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it's taking off in a private way the benefit of the certifications.
Uh-huh. Really.
I wanted to make sure that we also talked about alpacas, because alpacas here in Vermont are something that we've got. And I was interested in the All Things Alpaca Ecuador project.
Sure.
And how that works. And
well, the Sue White, who's one of the owners of All Things Alpaca, actually came to our launch meeting in 2007. So he's been connected with us since the very beginning, and has given us input on the idea. He and his wife run this project. They have a alpaca ranch in Ecuador. They have 600 wild alpacas. And mostly they're making things out of alpaca wool, without harming the spectacle bear. It's an Andean spectacle bear, which is the primary key wildlife on their property. And there's some ongoing research using wildlife camera traps to document, individual spectacle bears that are using the property and continue, they can identify individual bears that are surviving from season to season. So that's an example of one of the monitoring protocols that's in place. I think the market right now for All Things Alpaca is mostly regional for tourists there, but they are looking into ways to reach more global markets. And I believe they're working on a website as well, but the pictures I've seen of the products are just beautiful.
In a normal way of harvesting alpacas, how would that normally affect the spectacled bear?
Well, it doesn't really have to do with the harvest. It's more, conflict between spectacled bears and alpacas, so that traditional ranchers might choose. They also have pumas there. So a more traditional approach to that kind of conflict between predators and livestock might be to kill predators on site. And so they've pledged not to do that. And since they have a big ranch, and their neighboring ranches are now interested in getting wildlife friendly certified. So this is kind of another dream of ours, is that as we certify different properties or pieces of land, that this will kind of ripple out and start to create a wildlife-friendly blanket across, certain regions. And so that's kind of in process right now. They're hoping that their neighbors are going to adopt the same husbandry practices. So, they use different ways of raising the livestock, where they'll rotate pastures, they'll be checking up on the livestock, they'll be moving them out of pastures where they're more, some pastures are, just because of the topography, and this goes for the United States too, are more prone to predation. It might be that the forest edge comes right up to the edge of the pasture, which gives cover to predators, and so you wouldn't want to put lambing or calving or lambing livestock in pastures where there are predator dens or where there's good cover for predators. You'd want to move vulnerable livestock out of those pastures and to closer to where you were able to have herders or guard dogs or different kinds of fencing. Some producers might choose to bring livestock in at night, or to bring livestock that were calving closer to their to the center of the ranch where they had more human presence. So these are all different, they're predator-friendly practices, and that, same practices that wildlife-friendly producers would be using to avoid lethal, not have to use lethal control against predators.
And what could people do if they're interested in learning more or supporting these projects?
Thanks for asking that. you know, the first thing they could do is, besides buying the product, some of them are, you can go to the predator-friendly website, predatorfriendly.org, or the wildlife-friendly website to begin, if you're interested in purchasing some of these products, or you could contact me directly. So we'd love for you to purchase the products. We'd love for you to share the stories and to educate yourself about these issues. They're complicated, but really compelling, important issues that deal with human poverty and, you know, saving. I think what makes me most excited is these are, you know, by buying one product, you're helping save some of the most endangered wildlife in the world, helping support some of the poorest communities in the world in some of the most spectacular places left on Earth. And I just don't see how you could do more with your dollar than buying one of these products, besides being able to, you know, share a high, you know, buy a high quality product, whether it's for yourself or giving it as a gift. So we encourage people to buy the products, share the stories. We have a Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're sharing some of the stories and our activities on Twitter. And I just set up our Facebook page last night, so you can now follow us on Facebook.
Oh, excellent.
And, you know, if people have specific expertise that they want to volunteer, or, you know, we would love business partners, retail partners. We're looking, you know, we're a bunch of, for the most part, wildlife biologists, so there are plenty of things we don't know a lot about, and we'd like to bring people into our network that can help spread the word, because we just think this is such an exciting feel-good story overall, and a way to connect to so many important issues.
So possibly if you are a retailer and interested in marketing some of these or selling some of these products in your store.
Absolutely. We're also looking for distributors in the United States that would help with the import and warehousing and then getting the products to retailers. So if there are any distributors that are interested in wildlife-friendly products that are listening, we'd love to hear from you as well.
Well, thank you very much, Julie. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Laurel. It's been great.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Julie Stein, co-founder and secretary of the board of the Wildlife-Friendly Enterprise Network. We were talking about wildlife-friendly products and how they can help conserve threatened wildlife while contributing to the economic vitality of rural communities. Now, let me turn to another periodic update on elephant seals at Piedras Blancas Elephant Seal Rookery in California from Christine Heinrichs, a docent there. As you may recall, I first spoke with Christine Heinrichs on December 7, 2009, and again on January 13, 2010. When we spoke again recently, I asked her to give me another update on the latest adventures of the elephant seals on the beach.
It's spring, and that means that most of the seals have been weaned. They've nursed for 28 days or so, and they gain very rapidly 10 pounds a day and go from a birth weight of 60 to 85 pounds up to about 350 to 400 pounds. Now, one of the things, every year, of course, is different on the beach, but one of the things that happened this year with the El Nino is that we've had a lot of very violent storms combined with some very high surf events, and the entire beach in places has been inundated, and the pups have been washed off. And so the whole north end of the beach, where normally there's several hundred pups, has a few dozen on it now.
Oh, really? And that's quite a huge difference.
It's a huge difference. And the biologist is going to be going out this month and making a count of the wieners, so we will get an idea of the final numbers, but of course, in the interim, we really don't know how many were born and were lost, but we will be able to see the impact. There's normally between about 3,800 and 4,000 pups born on the beach and surviving, so we'll at least have some comparative numbers this year that I'll be able to report in another month or two.
What happens with the wieners? And have the males started leaving or the females started leaving?
Yes, the females are almost all gone. There were just a few left on the beach. And there are still quite a few adult males, although many have already gone. Oddly enough, on Monday, there was a female on the beach who looked quite large. You know, at this point, any of the females that are left have been nursing their pups for a long time, and they lose about 2 pounds for every pound that the pup gains. So they get really, really slim.
Oh, really?
They
do. Where can I get that diet?
Well, just don't eat for a month, and it'll work. That's one of the interesting things is that for humans, if you didn't eat or drink for a month, all these toxic things happen in your body. But these animals are adapted to that fast. They really need that fast to trigger other events.
Oh, interesting.
They are very metabolically, they're really interesting. So most of the females, by the end of lactation, they're so thin that you can sometimes sort of see their backbone, and they're really, really slender.
Somehow but you never think of an elephant seal as slender.
No, you don't. You don't. But each time of year, some of the males look very, very thin because they've been on the beach since December without eating anything.
What happens next then?
Well, what happens next for them is the females that they're thin, probably the fasting and losing a certain amount of weight triggers them to go into estrus, and they mate on the beach before they leave. What happens with that is they're so thin, really they couldn't support the development of a fetus right at this time. They start feeding, but that fertilized egg does not start developing for about 3 months. So the actual gestation is 8 months long, although they won't give birth for 11 months.
Really?
It's called delayed implantation. Yes. It really works out in their lives that they have the opportunity to eat and become stronger before the fetus starts developing. As well, these are animals that are not social in the ocean. So the males and the females wouldn't necessarily encounter each other under other circumstances when they're out in the open sea.
And then what happens to the males and to the pups?
Well, the wieners are on the beach now. They're nice and fat. It seems like many of them may have nursed more on those mothers who had lost their pups. So they were nursing any pup that came along. So that there's a lot of very fat wieners on the beach, and they are about to start learning how to swim. Gain so much weight so quickly, they have a lot of blubber. And so as they start, you know, once their mothers are gone, they won't eat until they start hunting. So that's 4 to 6 weeks there on the beach themselves fasting. But as they work out and start practicing swimming, they actually undergo a metabolic change, and they start converting that blubber into muscle.
Oh, interesting. Well, we'll really look forward to hearing more about the pups learning how to swim next time. So thank you so much for talking with me.
Okay, thanks, Laurel.
I hope you enjoyed that update on the elephant seals from Christine Heinrichs. You can continue to keep up to date on the elephant seals with Christine's new blog at http://elephantseals.blogspot.com. Now, let me play you today's creature call and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of a critically endangered species that lives in Cambodia and is the target of a wildlife-friendly project to sustainably produce rice in its habitat. Have an idea? It's the giant ibis. Once again, here's the call of the giant ibis. For next week's creature call, I'll move to the ocean where this vocal marine mammal lives. Here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it. Next week, I'll also talk with Ari Daniel Shapiro about killer whale vocalizations and what it really takes to research marine mammal sounds. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.